Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Eric Schwer. Eric Schwer has published three poetry collections, Cruel Folklore, The Saint of Withdrawal, and Whittling Lessons. His poems also appear regularly in literary journals, including Prairie Schooner, New Ohio Review, and Fence. Eric has led writing workshops for at-risk youth and adults recovering from mental illness and addiction. He is an associate professor of creative and professional writing for the University of Pittsburgh, Johnstown. Hi, Eric. How are you?
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, we're happy to have you on Prosody. I kind of thought that we had already had you as a guest, so I apologize, but we're really glad that you're here now.
Well, I'm really glad to be here. It's a great show, great city. Thanks for having me.
Of course, yeah. So you're going to start with some poems.
Yes.
Okay.
This first poem is called Whittling Lessons, and it's that title of the first book of poems. And it is true, I did take whittling lessons when I was a young man. But the poem's also a surreal reimagining of being able to go back and revisit those lessons. And I think it's a poem about guilt, about unfinished projects. Whittling Lessons. I'm beating my head against the belly of the man to whose home I once drove weekly to learn to whittle. It's hard now as then, a boulder beneath his shirt, and I want him never to have stopped trying. I am beating my head against the belly of the man to whose home I once drove to learn to whittle. It's hard now as then, but I want him to never have stopped trying to teach me. I bang my head until his flesh gives in, and I am up to my neck inside him. In the guts, I find my pocket knife. Why would he have swallowed it? I hold it to his enormous face, long dead, wave it wet before his eyes and broken beard. A hive of blood drags inside the present tense. He is still missing a knuckle and all of the finger above it. He takes my knife in that huge hand and squints, says it won't keep an edge, but sharpens it, and we begin to carve dogs from little blocks of oak. He helps me with the head, puts his tip below its nose, cuts the mouth. The next lesson, we carve chopstick-sized ribs, pull poplar strips between our thighs and blades, shaving them into thin ribbons we are to weave into heart-bottomed baskets next visit, and then I don't go back. I am too hungover, or I have a test, or I keep those sticks and ribbons for years before I burn them, and then I don't go back. I am cold and in need of kindling, and I've kept those poplar ribbons and sticks. They torch like a large nest, a mess, cracking up inside a pot-bellied stove I am still beating my head against. This next poem's called The Saint of Withdrawal, and it's the title poem of my second collection. I think it's about trying to find nature even in urban areas. I also have an outsider's fascination with Catholics' ability to find a saint for everything. The Saint of Withdrawal. It bats four times, soars, changes course, scrapes black on the milkish air, joined by three more. Ascending over the trees, the other side of Monroe muffler break, hurled claws, sooty tissues tossed into the dirty white. These are not those birds you've seen in the moving distance inside a daydream, slightly rising left to right, inspiring your real eye with real flight. No, these four have been in the dark, wet woods all night, perched in a rotten pine, standing on needles, wings outstretched, lifted like stooped old men in overcoats who frightened pigeons from the park. In the weak light, two tiny dots slide on the ice of the western sky, while down on the floor these guys begin to walk, sway and stalk, throwing forth one claw, criminal, yoked, lurching in the quiet cold to gawk or cock ahead, moving where nothing else does in the fog. When waste management's fleet shudders over the township blacktop, one takes flight. It takes it like the sick take time, taking all the air it can each flap, coasting until it needs again, making dashes, strikes on the sky, hooks, burnt matches, whatever can't be taken back. Another poem from The Saint of Withdrawal is called Quintessence. And I was trying to think about what connects us to relatives, aunts and uncles, cousins, even if we don't feel very much like them. And thinking about that medieval notion of quintessence, that thing that was not earth, air, fire, or water. And that fifth element, of course, must be blood. Quintessence. Uncle Bimmy lived up breakneck in a double wide that sat out back the property of Grandpa Heck. He'd flick his cigarette, then smack a stick against the fence, and we'd come zinging up the lot. Kneeling in the pungent dust the evening cast about his home, he'd drag the heavy stone off his well. We'd gather around, creep closer, peering down, as his one good hand stirred away the webs knit above the dankness. He'd speak of vapor that wasn't vapor, of smoke that stunk like breath, like hell, the spore of something smoldering, a seething in the hole. He'd say, this is what we must inhale to understand our kin. We ran, but won. Alone I put my mouth to pipe, that rusting way back in. What the drowning do. Monday, something brushed the diver's chest. He reached, but lost it to the blackness. Toward dusk, he hugged a small tire up from 30 feet, sat on the shore, and wept. In time, the child would do what all the drowned have done. Surface, be found. I can't remember why they knew that lake was where she was. I was 22, had read it in the local news, in the breakfast nook, a space swallowed by two facing hutches my girlfriend's father had made for each corner. It's remarkable the story even caught my eye amid that drift of bills and circulars, crayons and margarine tubs. Maybe it was something about an open door, cigarettes at the edge of the water, the word abandoned. My girlfriend would have been behind her house avoiding us, crying in the garage, fighting upstairs with her mom. I didn't know, none of us did, the family of that drowned girl. Little Jana and I were alone at the cluttered table eating or not eating or coloring, learning where clean bibs were kept and how to keep her hair behind her ear. I'd learned already to gasp like the rest, to stand so fast my chair shuddered on the floor, to grab her back from the glass, or in the den to snatch her from the TV before it collapsed. And soon I'd learned to kiss apologies against her protests, nuzzle my nose into her neck, feel her gulp for air, inhale the live smell of each sweet shriek as I held on to her.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Eric Schwer. He's reading some of his poems. Eric, I have a lot of ideas here. I wanted to ask you about something you said at the very beginning, and you talked about surreal imaginings in that first poem, and I thought it was that first poem was very wonderful about whittling lessons. Can you talk about your interest or your, I don't know if it's an obsession, but your interest with the surreal and using that in your poetry?
Well, I think it comes from a desire or a need to write about adolescence, but a fear or a paranoia of knowing that I don't have the capability to just write about adolescence straight in a way that I want or I think deserves readers. So if there's some way to add artifice or fictionalize it or to reshape it, to even lie and cheat with details or to make it as much about the poem or more about the poem and language and not just me retelling my life, I think. So adding that surreal layer, for example, I think in my mind makes the poem more public.
When you first started saying that, you were saying, I don't have the, what did you say? The skill set,
maybe, or the past. I think some people obviously have lives that we want to know how they became the women and men they become. We want to know about that childhood, and I wouldn't say there's anything particularly special about my adolescent experience that I feel like deserves a readership. So,
So I see what you're saying. Although, yeah, I mean, I'm a big believer in lying and stealing and poems, and finding the true story of the poem. In the poems that you've read, there seems to be a whole lot of emotion. And one thing I love about what you're reading is, and I kept hearing a couple times, was this motion of either coming back, what can be taken back, grabbing her back, how to get back. Mm. That kept coming up in those few poems that you read. And you prefaced, I guess, the first poem talking about guilt. Can you talk about that motion in your poems of coming back or grabbing something back as a repeated image?
Well, I don't know, except to say I do think about the past a lot, and I tend to perhaps obsess more about things that have happened rather than just being in the moment or plotting and planning a future and having goals in that direction. So I think I've kind of become an expert of sorts, maybe everyone is, on their own past, and I think if I'm going to just admit that I'm someone obsessed with my own past, I should probably find the best ways to revisit it. And I think poetry is one of those better ways rather than whatever the alternatives would be.
Yeah, comedy.
right, sure.
Okay, well, can you read some more poems?
Yes, I can. I'd like to read some from this newest book, Cruel Folklore. And there's a variety of different poems in there, but some are kind of ripped from the headlines poem. And this first poem is called How Do You Drown Five Children? And I read or heard on the news a terrible story about a mother who had done just that. And of course, my first question was probably everyone's question, how could you do that? And then my second question, maybe because I'm weird, was how would you do that? What would be the logistics? How do you drown five children? You start with your oldest, unless he somehow understands. Then you begin with your second. Make the first one help you hold him down in the porcelain tub. Or is it possible you kill the youngest first by accident while giving her a bath? Or the youngest are twins, unplanned. The other is outside on the swings as in your grief you dry both off, put them, cold skin, to sleep. Then through your bedroom screen, call Jonathan, who's three, and doesn't complain that you haven't drained the water since the twins. The struggle's no more than holding something inflatable under at the swimming pool. Still the problem remains. Your oldest will wonder where the others are. So yes, start with him. He's summer hot and itching. This poem's about bullying, I suppose. Another poem about adolescence. And there's a reference in it to these Christian t-shirts that look like heavy metal t-shirts. They're derivative of kind of heavy metal t-shirts. My t-shirt read, he is the rock upon which I stand, upon which was Christ's fist risen and grave fresh, out, clenched, a length of barbed wire entwiningly snaking from his arm to his palm. My God, muscle sweetened, peppered with pricks, as if shot had BB dotted it, it bled. Metal, not Christian metal. The neighbor's kid's shirt read butcher head. Much different than crown of thorns that summer, black flag, black kiss. I'd moved to a bad neighborhood and learned his name. Heard of, but never heard the band on his tight t-shirt, seventh grade, fading as if scrubbed, then hung on a line to dry, then stiffen in the sun maybe 13 times. For that gray summer I knew him, I prayed in both love and fear. He'd wouldn't turn into a jerk who thought I was some kind of queer. Several of the poems in this new book are ethnography. I think of them as ethnopoetics. I've had a relationship with a rural community in southeastern Kentucky since 1987 and did some oral history when I was down there, and some poems came from that type of work. Master Lock. 1. Ferris will crouch into the ditch line if you drive by of an afternoon and he's feeling sociopathic. He's let the pig grass get shoulder high, so you might not even see him disappearing in the weeds, RC or spade in his right hand, the left clutched in injury. Then, hearing only the hot bugs hissing shake, the creek pouring against its stony banks, he'll come back up, spit, tilt his head, sip his pop or grip his spade up close to the working end and keep using it to hammer whatever the hell he was hammering before you rounded the bend. 2. What he's hammering is a master lock he's lost the key for. He's using the spade because he done locked the hammer in the box. Just kidding. He's hammering the face of a watch. Look, now he's healing the tiny cogs and shattered glass into the dirt. Listen, he's fighting mad and out of breath. The box holds his dead sister's things. A medal for being dumb enough to register. A gun that fits inside your mouth. Fingers of Iraqi men. A lump she'd sworn was a penis tip. Here's a lesson, a key. Don't hold on to the stuff your kin have kept. Don't keep it in a box. Don't let no one catch you, one-handed, trying to wind your old man's watch.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Eric Schwer, reading his work. Can you talk to us a little bit about what you just mentioned, the ethnopoetics and your relationship with people in Southeast Kentucky?
Sure. Yeah. I did a type of study abroad, but it was in Appalachia when I was in college. It was a program out of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I went down there as an environmental science major at the time to help test the groundwater. There was a local woman who had brought a groundbreaking class action suit against a strip mining company with some help from some D.C. lawyers. And I was sent there to test the groundwater and ended up just getting involved in the community, doing some work with low-income housing type of grassroots kind of Habitat for Humanity work, and ended up falling in love that summer with that area and that geography and those people. And after some time, I was able to live there for 2 years as a full-time volunteer, had some grants from the Oral History Commission, did some recording of stories. Never much came from it, but here we are almost 30 years later, and in these last 5 or 6 years, I've started to work some of these people and some of this geography and some of this language into these poems.
Yeah, I mean, you said nothing much came from it. Sounds really important. It sounds really important to you and to what was happening there. And now I think we're lucky to have these poems. Can you talk a little bit about the process of, prior to that you had talked about finding poems or writing poems from things that were happening in the papers or in the world, and in a way this seems like another version of that with, something really important happening in the world, and how do you get from that to poetry? I mean, that may be the unanswerable question, but how do you do that?
I don't know. I feel like, obviously there are poets out there who are very gifted at talking about this and whole books that devote themselves to this finding the muse or however we want to put it. For this book, a lot of these poems started with my sense of what they'd look like before they were finished, that each line would have 11 syllables and each poem would have 16 lines. So I called them fat sonnets because they're just a little bit wider and a little bit longer. And that's really the engine that got them written. I knew I was not thinking about meter or rhythm, just pure quantitative, just pushing out syllables, trying to get to that 11th syllable, then to the next line. And I think some ugliness came out of that, some unpoetic language, and I think I found that exciting and inspiring. It took some pressure off. I was aware that I wasn't using any previous affectations or voices I'd used before. I'd kind of discovered some new voice, as ugly or plain as it was. That was exciting.
Mm-hmm. How did you land on the 11 syllables and the lines?
I forget. So it was a while ago when these poems first started to come.
You forget?
I forget.
That seems really big. It's like...
I would have become aware of, you know, quantitative syllabics through my own education through teaching my students.
Yeah.
So I think it was just probably a project I'd given myself out of some desperation or some need to get the juices flowing.
Mm-hmm.
Just giving myself an assignment as a way to produce something.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the numerology of it. I wonder what 11.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny. I did it for so long that wrote so many poems that didn't show up in the book that I started thinking in 11 syllables. Like I'd say something or hear something said to me, and I would know it was 11 syllables, and then I'd count them out. And indeed, I was right. Just started hearing language in 11 syllable chunks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would write a poem about that. Did you write a poem about that?
I probably have some meta poems that actually use the word 11 syllables in them in my junk drawer somewhere, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just had this image when you raised your hand when you said that of counting syllables as people were talking. It sounds like a good poem. Anyway, could you read some more poems?
Sure. A lot of these poems from this book, the title is also the first line. This is a licks, a mistake, a creek tries to forget. And that line survived revisions. That's 11 syllables. And a lick is a body of water smaller than a creek, maybe bigger than a stream, or maybe not. You might, may or may not know that. I became really interested in how people talk about geography in the land when I lived in this rural area in Kentucky, hollers and gaps and et cetera. So I guess you need to know a lick is a thing smaller than a creek. A lick's a mistake a creek tries to forget. A creek's much bigger, something the river must accept. Except Crummy's Creek, which enters the Cumberland as just a puny stream, dammed 13 miles up its mouth and made to flood the mining town. You'd need to boat to the middle to feel as if it might still be down there, deep, current broiling the eaves, undermining the commissary, washing through the submerged trees. But you're on the beach, spread with a grit the quarry sells for sand. Lake so full it seems to tilt the level land. And there's a girl, in up to her knees, who turns, so you see the red lick down her belly rush into her cut-off jeans. Some scar her flesh won't correct, her sister's child held against her hip. This next poem is instructions to how to get someone's off your mind, how to get someone's name, as it were, off your tongue. If your life has become a terrible bone or just fangs at the end of a spine, white as bone, dry and dull and dead as a drawer full of knives. If you've vague space before death in which you twitch and use pain to scratch her name with your nails and dust. If the cock with one claw spells it again as his brain lies alone, limp on the butchering block. If the snake spells its one S again and again while the gardener wipes the axe with his boot. If you can't help but think of the worm which wiggled round, wound in dread too long after getting halved by your grandpa's thumb. If now you're just nerves which writhe like the bait you were slapped for dumping out of the boat. Joy, just a nibble of meat, then abruptly a jolt, your cheek torn, ripped, as if metal ate into your throat. Don't say it again, what it was, her name. Use pliers to pull out that hook. Listen. Here, every evening, a woman strides into her backyard calling her rabbit, which raises an ear when she sings. Peppermint's eyes are red, his fur's so white, oh, where's Peppermint gone tonight? When she sees him, she relaxes and lingers in twilight as fireflies make brief green slashes and blacktop ticks with the heat it's digested all day. Then in her grass, while the light collapses, I watch her daydream a portion of the dusk away. I mean, I imagine she daydreams as through my screen I watch her stride about shoeless, her rabbit nibbling the lawn going gray. In a clean blouse, fresh from a shower, night coming on, she might think of marriage. The lace curtains in the windows of her house are drawn. In my own still air and losing light, I stare at her, her curtains, her rabbit's white hair. Downstairs at the sink in my darkening kitchen, a glass of iced water is crying a ring. Has he hopped the gate, left me again? Peppermint, please, she continues to sing, though it has not wandered and would not ever leave. Soldier, private, strong-armed Christ. Soldier, throw down your arm. Wipe the other one of the blood. Request the medic's tourniquet. Return to base. Beg them cut clean your bone. Accept the folded skin, the black, livid stitches. Requesting disabled deployment? Yeah, I went back in the action again. Private, sent in Iraq won, left Somalia unwon, now poppies and dust, the high crags stoned with snow, land which your son might someday see, then die. In those snow-capped crags, the snow leopard, blurred through binoculars, recklessly attacks panicked, clattering yak. Strong-armed Christ, mouth bloodied by the wheel, your doorless Humvees left your lieutenant legless, also aghast. From a click, a village quits its work, squints from their field toward the blast, toward you. Flail your good arm in distress. Wave. Let them save you.
We have time for one more.
There was a nasty magazine. There was a nasty magazine Kurt took from his father's hunting camp and kept beneath a log, where Widow Rock lay her poor head onto Sandy's branch. We weren't to touch it unless Kurt was there. But how could he stop us? Each glossy photo was orange, pink naked, the colors of stuff we pricked and prodded in that summer woods. Then the pages grew heavy and rank, wavy like gills beneath the hoods of mushrooms fixed against the trees. Soon the magazine began to mold, dampen, and separate, until each woman could be ripped thin as tissue from her page. We'd cup them in our palms, kneel by the bank, allow the creek to lift their skin and take them off our hands.
The poetry of Eric Schwer. Thank you so much. That was great.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.